are friends with fantasy benefits.
Mike, how hard are you right now?
Oh man, I've been hard since you said hi, welcome to Friends with Fantasy Benefits podcast.
From the fastball last year. I think that was a big reason for the overall.
We are friends with fantasy benefits.
A little scruffly, but I'm okay. Scruffly, how you like that for a word? Scruffly.
I think it's the first I've ever heard it used, but...
We are friends with fantasy benefits.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a Friends with Fantasy Benefits concept podcast. It is Monday, April 9th. We are excited to be here for you. I've noticed a trend that's really going on that seems really hot this year, and that trend is towards looking at exactly how many swinging strikes these pitchers are creating. And I really want to delve into exactly how predictive and how active we should be in following this and see exactly, just delve mentally into exactly how much value swinging strike rate actually has as a predictive force within fantasy baseball. But before we get to all that, let me introduce Dr. Andrew Dewhurst. Not actually a doctor, I guess. But anyway, Andrew, how are you today?
I'm doing all right, Chuck. How about you?
I am okay. I fought off illness for most of last week that cost us a Wednesday podcast last week, which was too bad because we were going to have Shelley on as well on Wednesday on the quiz show podcast. So this week I'm rebounding, so I sound a little scruffly, but I'm okay. Scruffly, how you like that for a word? Scruffly.
I think it's the first I've ever heard it used, but I suppose that doesn't make that any more right or wrong.
Yeah, that's probably true. All right, well, Andrew, your Twitter handle is?
At Andrew K. Dewhurst.
Did I say twiddle handle? anyway, my Twitter handle is at just chucking it, as we all know. And one brief aside before we get to the concept of the day. Andrew, did you pick up anybody on Fab yesterday?
I don't think so. I think from TGFBI standpoint, I didn't. I think I lost out on Chad Kuhl for a start this week against the Marlins. But I think in the Battle of the Podcast League, I might have these backwards as well. I guess that's my issue with having six of these things running right now. I was able to get Adam Ottavino before his arm falls off.
Well, there you go. Adam Ottavino. Okay, did you pick up Adam Ottavino? Is Wade Davis having some problems I haven't heard of, or are you just speculating?
That one's just speculation. It's a deep, I think it's like 36-man rosters, so having that depth, and I was dropping Mike Soroka, who isn't probably going to play in the majors this year, who I had grabbed as speculation in draft. So,
quite interesting. Well, I am the proud owner of Corey Knebel in TGFBI, because why wouldn't I be? Why wouldn't I be? So I put in what I thought was a pretty hefty bid for who I believe gets quite a chance at filling in for him, and that's Jacob Barnes. And of course, my bid was not good enough to get Barnes, but I was good enough to get Albers, and I do think Albers is the guy. If we suffer through a couple more Jacob Barnes implosions, I think we're going to see Albers get the gig. So I don't forecast that, but I really didn't have much choice in TGFBI. I also was the owner of Dominic Leone in that in that format for TGFBI, and of course that was before they went out and got the last closer on the market, Greg Holland. So I got him, and then I for the two start week I put in a fairly sizable bid for Marco Gonzalez. Kind of frustrated on how that league is going, so I wanted to. Fortunately for me, there's a guy in my league who's a solid 30 points behind me, so I know I'm not going to finish last in TGFBI, which I think is really important. Just mentally, I don't want to be the dead last in the overall.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I had a rough weekend. I think I was top 10 last Thursday at the 1 week mark, but I've dropped down considerably since then. I think I'm staying in the 60 range right now.
Yeah, I've had a few really ginormous swings and misses so far this season, and the first one being Logan Morrison, who I thought was going to feel a lot of incentive from this one year deal, which with all these extra added options that can kick in and all this and what have you. And so far he's been absolutely dreadful, maybe more putrid than he's been in the last 5 years. Obviously it's only a couple weeks and maybe he can snap out of it yet, but he would help me a lot if he would wake up. All right, on the subject of swinging strike rate, a number of different outlets that I listen to are very, very closely monitoring swinging strikes and seem to be using them as the ultimate predictive force in pitching quality. And I struggle mentally with this. My reactionary nature automatically wonders out loud how much better a swinging strike is versus a looking strike. And it also notes in my head that hitters have a tendency to want to be patient at the plate. And so the early strikes that you get in the count are often seem to be like they're looking strikes. And that's can set up and lead towards very weak contact, which weak contact, while not as glamorous for us fantasy players because weak contact usually just means recorded outs, not strikeouts, I still believe that weak contact is something that built up over time. Would you rather have a guy have an 8 or a 9 pitch at bat that ends in a strikeout, or would you rather have him have a 3 or 4 pitch at bat that ends in weak contact? Is one of the mental questions that I have going into this. Obviously, to me, and I'm so leaning on my friend Andrew here today because this seems further in his wheelhouse than mine, it seems to me that swinging strike percentage completely excludes BABIP against, it completely excludes strand rate, and completely excludes the home run to fly ball ratios. Which seem to be very intrinsic in what we look at as FIP or XFIP. So that's my first question to you, Andrew, is how do you think about that as framing of swinging strike percentage, and what do you think as an overview of why it's so beloved within the sabermetric community?
Well, swinging strike rate is really, it's more of an indicator of stuff, right? Like the best way to think of it is, if I'm, I think Noah Syndergaard had the highest swing strike rate in 2016. It was like 16%. Well, part of the reason he's going to have a high swing strike rate is because he throws 100 miles an hour, and then anything off of 100 miles an hour looks suddenly like it's not moving, or your swing's already sped up, so things get missed. So it's loved in fantasy baseball because it's a key indicator around probably your striking potential. Guys with really high strikeout rates are going to have, or swing strike rates are probably going to have a really high amount of strikeouts. If you look at I
I say quickly, but it probably took me an hour and a half because I had to hand feed a lot of the data. When I did a comparison of swing strike rate in 17 compared to 16, I mean, what seemed to actually join was that the pitchers that we consider elite seem to continue to increase their swing strike rate. The biggest movers from 16 to 17 was Danny Salazar, who had 16.4% up from 11.1, which were both very good numbers. Tanaka, which was 15.1 to 10.9. And these aren't guys, when you look at those numbers, like the swing strike rates are great, but both have enormous warts. I mean, Tanaka had an ERA near 5 last year. So I think we have a tendency to get carried away with our love of strikeouts, because strikeouts aren't necessarily indicators of good ERAs or WHIPs either.
Well, it's curious that you brought up this chart, which you made for us for the show, which I really appreciate, which basically was a nice little measurement of the delta between the swinging strike rates of 2017 and 2016. Mentally, when I looked up the pitcher list that we have today to talk around our concept, one thing that really jumped off the page at me is that 2017 in and of itself is a very hard demarcation to use to me. And I'm really curious as to if you agree with me. Like, 2017 appears to be the start of an entirely new stat era in baseball because of launch angle, because of the different baseball. And those, I guess, would be the two biggest reasons. But because of the launch angle and the different baseball, it seemed like strikeouts really went through the roof for a lot of Major League Baseball and of hitting. And so swinging strike percentage was... The real question is was the swing plane switched enough in 2017 with this new fly ball revolution that swinging strike percentage in and of itself is hard to take from the year 2017 and put in context with the years that were before it? How do you feel about that?
I'm not certain that I agree. I mean, I think the things we have to keep in mind is that in 2017, we became aware of the quote-unquote fly ball revolution and things like that. It doesn't mean it was the first time it had happened. It may have been a growing trend over years. I mean, personally, I haven't checked any of that actual data to see if that's true or otherwise, but I think we have to adjust that thought in our mind a little bit, is that just because we're hearing about it doesn't mean it's the first time it's actually occurring. But I mean, that being said, like, are strikeouts up? Yes, they are. I think strikeouts have been up for years, though, for the last couple of years, though. And that's, I mean, that probably makes 2017 not that much different from 2016. But at the same time, you mean, it should be considered, because I mean, it's a full year worth of statistics, and I don't think we're aware of any change that's happened moving forward. So it may end up being more of the benchmark as we continue moving forward for a couple more years until adjustments change and the game inevitably changes every few years.
You feel like the ball, the difference in the ball now, I mean, the only notable blister issue that I've been hearing a lot about, obviously, is Tim Lincecum in his return. That hasn't happened yet. Looks like it might be like a couple months out. Tim Lincecum could be this year's Aaron Sanchez, from what I gather, because his throwing program has not really yet been able to start because of blister issues. But, you know, this year we got Aaron Sanchez back. But do you think the ball is dramatically different, or do you just assume, like, obviously if the ball is the same for everyone, so But at the same time, that could be part of the reason why strikeouts were up last year as well. If the ball bothered certain pitchers and created blister issues, like we thought with Aaron Sanchez, and there was other people that noted and disliked, you know, the way the seams feel on the baseball versus years past. Well, then that conceivably there were pitchers that were getting a significant gain from having a different feel on the baseball. You think that's also overblown, or do you think that that's at play here?
I would say it's probably going to be overblown. I mean, it's the blister problem affects such a small percentage of overall pitchers that it's hard to say that it's a problem, right? What was perceived as being the problem is that the seams weren't as raised on last year's baseball. So maybe they've corrected that, and the seams are now raised to the same height as it was previously. So it's leading to less blisters because pitchers aren't having to try to grip the ball so hard. But, I mean, I guess it's hard to understand what to make of it, right? Like, it didn't seem to make any difference for Chris Sale, who struck out 300 batters last year. Yeah. I mean, like, how is it different from one player to the next? They're all using the same ball, right? So, I suppose there's the potential for the Rays seem to slow the ball down a little bit more because it's now offers more wind resistance as it rotates and stuff like that, but I don't know. I think it's a lot of anomaly if at this point in time.
Well, we have a lot to speculate upon as the year goes through as well, because we're also going to be the ongoing. I mean, the first 4 or 5 days of the season was an ongoing joke about the humidor in Arizona in and of itself. So the ball conditions, the condition of the actual ball that's used is going to be up for a lot of scrutiny this year with what we see going on in Arizona, which does not seem to have a dampened offensive environment at all like we thought it was going to. And yet, remember that you're still at a different time of year too. So if you're going to delve into ball conditions to that extreme, you have to remember that the playing conditions in Arizona are somewhat different this time of year than when I went there and it was 122 degrees outside. And in their air conditioned indoor stadium, it was 94 degrees in the seats when I was there. So I think you're going to see that this scrutiny over the actual baseball is going to continue. But I don't think that lessens our discussion about swinging strike percentage. And I really want to delve into the player list today and try to think about what we can gain from these players as far as if we believe in swinging strike percentage as a predictive force. The first player that we're going to talk about is one of my favorite players this year, and that is Jameson Taillon, who is 26 years old. He has a 1.26 ERA here early on, fresh off a complete game shutout. His numbers seem to correlate with some of the predictive values that we're looking for here, because his K percentage is up 10.05 this year from 8 last year, and his walk rate has been cut in half so far. Small sample size, I realize. The point being, he's been a very hot pitcher, and he's also somebody that I extended myself greatly in an auction in one of my local leagues to get, and so he is paying off for me mightily right now. So when you looked at the your chart, what jumped off the chart for you about Jameson Taillon?
Is that his low swinging strike percentage. Jameson Taillon has been very effective this year. I mean, you mentioned the complete game shutout. One hit the Reds yesterday, which is, I mean, I think we can all agree the Reds are not a great team, but it is a good lineup, which is
that, which I mean is impressive in itself, right? So you look at Tyon and you start looking at the numbers and you say, you know, maybe this is a guy that can break out. But when you look at his swing strike percentage, trying to be an indicator of his success, it's not actually there. Which would mean a couple of things. One, I expect his 10.05 K per nine is not going to last. It'll regress back down to probably his career norms, which will put it probably around eight and a half, maybe a little bit lower given he's only getting 8% swinging strikes. But I think he's the first player I look at to say swinging strike rate is not your be all end all. Because his is only in the typically only in the eights, which is would be a number that you would have people excluding him from a group because you would say, oh, Tyon doesn't must not strike anybody out because his swing strike rate's so low.
Well, I want to be really careful in this discussion because naturally, when you try to draw information from a chart, okay, we are naturally going to look at outliers, and that doesn't. It's going to offer us the exception to maybe what we think the rule is, or we have to be careful to make sure that that's not all that it's offering us is the exception. I would also say that Jameson Tyon, you know, is sort of a pitcher who's been coming into his own, and he's obviously had some health hiccups, and so I'm curious. I'm curious as to how this is going to play out. You say that you think that he's going to go back to his career norms, and I'm almost of the belief that maybe he's ready at some breakout level to set a new standard for where I think he can pitch. That is certainly part of what went into me being so high on Jameson Tyon. I believe I paid $21 for him in an auction.
And let me just correct part of that, though, is that I think his K per nine will regress back to its career norms. But if his walk percentage stays, like if his walk per nine stays at 1.26, you could definitely see a significant increase in his production this year.
Yeah, and of the NL Central teams, I think that he pitches in the right ballpark for certain. I also think that the infield defenses could be maybe a little improved. You know, I'm not a big fan of Josh Bell at first base, but it sure seems like, you know, Moran is an upgrade at third, and their outfield defense has long been applauded, and I think that could really help him as well as far as being a guy who could, you know, maybe not have the most dominating stuff, but still have the numbers turn out to be very, very, very good. And so I'm definitely a Jameson Tyon believer, and I did think it was curious that he is not his 9.4% swinging strike rate so far in 2018 certainly does not seem to match his incredible performance. Quite naturally, the FIP and the XFIP are a little bit higher, but almost any time you get somebody whose ERA is below 2, they're generally their FIP and their XFIP are going to be higher. I think FIP and XFIP has some idea of regression towards the mean built into it. So when you have this incredible outlier over a short sample size, usually the FIP and the XFIP is going to be higher. So Jameson Tyon is an interesting guy. I really like his chances of being a top 15 pitcher this year. Do you think that's overly aggressive?
Not necessarily. I mean, it's going to be probably take a lot to be top 15. I mean, I hope it happens. I also own shares of Tyon in a few leagues, so I'd be really happy to see that. There's a lot. I mean, it's really hard to judge what you've got right now from him, just for a few reasons, right? I mean, sample obviously being the biggest reason. We're only like, 10, 11 days into the season. And I think pitchers have some advantage this time of year, especially when you look at where Tyon has been pitching. I think it's been pretty cold in the northern third of
of the playing field so far. And you had Fernando Rodney catching snowflakes in his mouth at a game in Pittsburgh last week. You've had had games snowed out in New York. So, it's cold. I think the cold affects the hitters more than the pitchers. So, some of this I'm going to take with a grain of salt, but I am also a Taillon believer.
Well, the other thing is it's going to be. I want to see if Pittsburgh can maintain this, because for a team that is known for to be selling off their assets, their lineup is not a Detroit Tigers lineup right now. It's not a Miami Marlins lineup by any means. And so I do think there is also something to be said for, a little more upside in wins than we may have thought, purely from what the moves on the surface looked like over the offseason for the Pirates. So Jameson Taillon is going to be very interesting to keep tabs of this year. The next person that we're going to talk about is Masahiro Tanaka. And he has yet to give up a walk this year. And he's, and his strikeout percentage is at 10.95. His 14.5% swinging strike rate right now is slightly down from 15.1% last year. And the irony, of course, is that 15.1% swinging strike rate both was in perfect sync with his worst year as a Yankee, which was, briefly touched on already, that that he had nearly a 5 ERA last year. I was pretty big on Tanaka. I was bullish on Tanaka this year. First of all, I think that people have a tendency to exaggerate his chances of further injuring his elbow. That's certainly, even to this day, is nothing that happened to Irvin Santana. And I was also bullish on him because I believe that he was going to get a ton of extra run support, which all of a sudden I think maybe our friend Stanton is pressing himself into some sort of very odd slump, which we have seen from Stanton before. But I still like that offense, even if Stanton is not hitting. So how do you feel about Tanaka, and was the fact that we don't consider him an upper level ace, but he has a huge swinging strike percentage, is that your reason for pointing him out to us?
Yeah, he was one that I wanted to point out as great swinging strike rate, not very good ERA. This year looks like it. Maybe it's a little bit different. Maybe we're going to get it closer to a 2016 style ERA. But he's a guy that's always had the ability to strike people out. I mean, he struck out 194 batters last year in 178 innings. Obviously, we all like the 10.95 K per nine. Last year was 9.79, which is still fantastic. The walks are going to come. I mean, it looks like there's been some change in his pitching profile this year. He's gone to become very slider heavy. It's up to 45.8% of his pitches so far this year, based on the pitching info from Fangraphs. It's more or less dropped the sinker. It's down to just 3.6%. So I think there's there's definitely changes that are happening here. I'm not sure what to make of his, the MCL tear. It's been a few years now. It doesn't look like it's going to tear. And there's been a few other pitching examples of, you don't necessarily need to get Tommy John if it's not completely torn. Irvin Santana being one, and I believe David Price is now becoming adding himself into that list as well as a guy who didn't get Tommy John and is pitching effectively without it. So, if I just see Tanaka definitely as a swinging strike rate darling, 14.5. He's always been over 10%, which is typically which I consider to be very good myself. He just kind of becomes the forgotten man. And I remember specifically in my TGFBI draft,
I grabbed him, I think, just right around the 100th pick. And every, like, at least three or four people in my draft were, like, were kind of giving me some text that I consider, like, a funny look of, like, are you sure you want to grab Tanaka here? As they kind of all noted that they were had gotten burnt by him pretty badly last year, so.
Well, one of the things, I mean, I guess this is what makes me an analyst, is that I question a lot of these things, and my question, one of my questions about swinging strike rate is this. Okay, early in the count, if a guy has a reputation of being somebody who is a strike thrower, right, he's not going to walk you, then you think to yourself, well, I need to look for the best pitch that I possibly can, even early in the count, and swing at it. When younger pitchers, especially, and early in the season, when people are more concerned about building up pitch counts to get the person out of the game, then you're going to take a lot of those early pitches instead. And when I looked around, I was having a hard time finding looking strike rate, which is, you know, to me, a strike is a strike, by and large. You know, a looking strike early in the count maybe induces weaker contact later instead of a swing and miss. But it's still to the pitcher's advantage to have gotten ahead in the count. And I wonder that it seems to me like there's going to be this natural curve where, you know, take another guy that I thought was really interesting that I didn't point out to you, but Zach Greinke is another guy, okay? Well known to have very, very good control. He's not going to go out and walk six or seven guys and get himself into a ton of trouble almost ever, okay? And the point being is that Zach Greinke is a guy who, at this point in his career, is thinking to himself, one of my main goals is to pitch deep into a game. Okay, so if he gets ahead of somebody, you know, 0-2, right, he could nibble with pitches that maybe come swinging strikes for a strikeout, or he could throw just really good pitches that people have to protect the plate on and make them hit themselves into making an out, which for fantasy baseball might not be as exciting, but for an Arizona Diamondbacks fan, they say to themselves, well, I don't know exactly how long Taiwan Walker's going to be able to go. Robbie Ray's going through a little bit of a struggle right now. I mean, so the fact that maybe him saving himself three or four extra pitches on that one batter means that he goes 7 2/3 instead of 6 2/3 in that given start. And that makes a huge difference in the real baseball world, a lot bigger difference in the real baseball world than it matters in the fantasy baseball world. Do you see where some of my skepticism comes from?
Absolutely. And just for the record, though, there is a statistic for percentage of pitches seen inside the strike zone, which is zone percentage. So, like, Tanaka in this case is an interesting example, because for his career, 42% of all of his pitches are inside the strike zone. So I think you add, which seems to be pretty normal. I'm just looking across the players that we talked about. I mean, Taillon's 44.2. He's at 40.1% this year. So, I mean, essentially 4 to 6. Like, I understand your point, right? At times we overvalue strikeouts. If we're just looking for the players that strike the most people out, you always run the risk of grabbing a bunch of guys who look like Tanaka did last year. Robbie Ray's had those years. I think 2 years ago where he struck out like 220 batters, but had a 5 ERA. Like, there's more to the game and the fantasy game than strikeouts. Like, strikeouts only account for one total, but you would rather have, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, in Roto, would you rather lose strikeouts and win ERA and WHIP
I think you would, right? You take two categories to one, but you don't you don't really hear about people saying, I'm going to punt strikeouts.
Well, the other interesting point here is that when we draft pitching in general, when we draft pitching, we do this balance of huge upside with steady performance. And we also know going in that perhaps the most difficult, the most, we have the most volatility within the pitching that we draft, and we know that. And Greinke was, I'm glad I brought Greinke up because, like, I drafted Greinke early this offseason because I thought he was about as safe as you could possibly get amongst the top. After the top four, he was your next safest option by far. I guess Syndergaard has turned out, looks really wonderful right now, but, you know, there was concerns about him coming off injury. Carrasco doesn't have a long serviceable track record. I mean, we could go, Aaron Nola, all these different, of these second tier of pitchers, I thought Zach Greinke was the one that not only was the safest, but also had the possibility of getting an uptick because of the humidor helping situation even further. So anyway, so that leads into the next pitcher that we're going to discuss, because he is also a guy that people have drafted for over the last 3 or 4 years, have really fallen in love with drafting him to be a steadying force / anchor within the volatility of pitching. And that is one Jose Quintana. And his reputation is definitely steady and not spectacular. And he fits our discussion extraordinarily well, because from the years 2013 to 2016, when his ERA was in the low threes every single year, his range of swinging strike percentage went from 7.6% to 9.2%. All numbers which are well below elite. So I'm very curious on where the study of Jose Quintana, where looking at him within this context, led Andrew Dewhurst.
Well, Quintana is interesting. This is where I think you get kind of a little bit of a join between the two theories, right? Quintana struck out 207 batters last year. We would all agree that anything over 200 should be considered extremely valuable. First time in his career. Oddly enough, it was the first time in his career that he hadn't hit 200 innings in the year. Well, not the first time in his career, but the first time in the last 5 years. He's a pitcher who typically is getting you over 175 strikeouts because he gives you pitching volume. Because he's, based on his swing strike percentage, I would guess he's not a guy who's going out and trying to strike out every single batter. Like maybe someone like a Tanaka would, or maybe Chris Sale being another example of, especially earlier in his career, where you would get into situations where you're out in five innings because you've already blown through your 100-110 pitches. So Quintana's always a guy that I believed in, and it's because, he's a pitcher. He can strike you out, but it's not his primary objective, much like a Zach Greinke would be, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's are definitely two of the shining examples that we have of pitchers who have largely succeeded and at times been very, very successful without creating this swinging strike percentage, which we are apparently really searching out as a pitcher attribute. I also want to mention with Quintana, and I am the team concept or the team context guy amongst all of seemingly all of our analysts, that there was a lot to like about Quintana moving from the White Sox to the Cubs to begin with. I think it's a really great career move for him too, as he's going to approach free agency here, in the next couple of years. But you get a much better environment to pitch in and get to pitch in the National League versus pitching in a much more homer-friendly park like he did across town in Chicago before he moved to the Cubs. So I love Quintana for the rest of the year, and I think perhaps he's been largely undervalued this season. Do you agree with that?
I think so. Like, he struggled a little bit. He was a guy that I really liked going into this year, but didn't manage to get any shares of because he actually went higher than I was expecting him to, or I was willing to pay, just kind of based on the range he was going in. And I would very much love for Quintana to have the first half he had last year and the second half he had last year, because I know in my home league last year, I picked him up off waivers because no one wanted him. And I think as far as the team context goes, I think the other thing that sometimes gets forgotten is, I mean, I would be really surprised. It's a difference in clubhouse, right? You would expect, you know, coming into work every day to a team that probably is, you know, people know they're not necessarily going to go out and win every day, to a team that expects to win every day. And I think that's also partly where you see a little bit of the mystique of Joe Maddon come into play as well, is that, well, he drives us fantasy analysts up the wall with, you know, his constant moves and his unpredictable lineup and things like that. Players do seem to genuinely really like playing for him. So I think that also is definitely something in the favor of Jose Quintana this year.
Yeah, I mean, every once in a while, very trade-active leagues, you'll have people trying to get a massive ace from you, and they want to give you a bat, and they say, you know, well, which one of my pitchers would you like back with this person to consider giving me Noah Syndergaard, or consider giving me, you know, an elite pitcher? And I just think that people would have a natural tendency to not be drawn to Quintana. Or maybe he's somebody that you could get that other owner to give up easier than he should. And I think Quintana is in for a very, very large year this year. All right, the next pitcher that we're going to speak of seems to be an anomaly in every way, shape, or form, sort of always has been. You know, he raised the ire of Miguel Montero back when he was a young farmhand trying to make his way up in Arizona, and that got him sent to one place, and they got sent to another place. Well, anyway, the point being is that Trevor Bauer, from 2014 to 2017, his swinging strike percentage was 9 to 9.6. He's a very curious guy because he points out one of the exclusions in thinking about swinging strike percentage, and that is home run to fly ball ratios. He had a 16.1% home run to fly ball ratio in 2017, and he had an 8.7% home run to fly ball ratio in 2014. You know, it's just curious to try and figure out why Trevor Bauer seems to be a bit of an outlier within swinging strike percentage theory. What do you think about Trevor Bauer in this context?
Personally, I really like Trevor Bauer in the most general sense, in that Trevor Bauer is a player who's truly made himself. He's learned how to add velocity. He's done it through the weight room. He's done it through other scientific means. However, along the way, this has made him, I mean, he's also well known to be a tinkerer. He's always tinkering with pitches. I think at times he's carried like, you know, a 6 or 7 pitch repertoire, which is kind of bizarre, and I can only imagine the conversations with Yan Gomes and, you know, Roberto Perez around, you know, which finger is which pitch? I don't remember. I mean, swing strike percentage, he's just going to be a player that's going to be all over the map with this kind of thing. Like, 9.5% is not great. But he did manage to strike a lot of people out. I think he's doing it in other ways at times. I mean, he's
you know, I think because of that repertoire of pitches and that reputation, he's probably harder to predict in the hitter's mind. And if I remember correctly, he'd also gone to it almost largely away from the fastball last year. I think that was a big reason for the overall change in what some of the things we saw from him.
Yeah, he's always seems to be a good case study for a lot of different things. I'm curious how you feel about. I want to compare him to somebody on his own staff. You know, Clevinger, Steve Clevinger is a guy that Mike Clevinger. Steve must be a former catcher, right? Anyway, Mike Clevinger is a guy who a lot of people caught a lot of helium during the draft season. Would you rather have Mike Clevinger for the rest of the year, or would you rather have Trevor Bauer?
I think I'd rather have Trevor Bauer just because it's a little bit more of a known commodity, even though we don't necessarily know what part of that commodity we're going to get. I mean, I'll take either, like happily take either, just because we kind of have a pretty good indication of what the AL Central is going to be. And it's not rainbows and butterflies. So, I mean, both players probably look to be pretty valuable at this point in time.
Yeah, I mean, they both look to be valuable. I think the interesting thing about Clevinger is he's coming off a very odd start, one where, you know, I think he had three double plays and a man thrown out at home within four innings, and so he just gave up just a myriad of base runners in Clevinger's last outing, but he was still very successful. You know, he pitched relatively deep into the game, and you know, he pitched deep into the game and he only gave up one earned run. So, and that's another thing that I find it's difficult to really start delving too much into stats for this year because one outlier game, you know, could be that game that you had in the first 2 weeks. And so maybe that's not exactly who the pitcher is. I do think I saw Clevinger go around the same times as Bauer. Matter of fact, I saw him go earlier in a few different drafts, and some of that was my fault. I was really into Clevinger as a huge breakout this year. And so Trevor Bauer is not only touches on a lot of these different things that we've talked about with swinging strike rate, but I also want to note that small pitchers that aren't real tall, will always be looked at to be in danger of giving up a lot of home runs because they don't have the downward plane to the plate that helps keep the ball lower in the zone. And so it's also curious that Trevor Bauer is a guy who's fought home run to fly ball rates because it's more difficult, especially for a guy who's not a pure sinker ball pitcher. You know, like Marcus Stroman sort of gets away with it because he has natural sinking action on top of the fact that, you know, on top of the fact that he's a shorter pitcher. So that subset of pitchers that don't have the prototypical size get looked at somewhat like you get shorter quarterbacks in the NFL get looked at. There's ways around not being a tall NFL quarterback. But at the same time, when they start to struggle, if they start to struggle at all, it's what immediately gets pointed back to. And I think that's the case. And Bauer's not, you know, ultimately crazy short, but at the same time, he's just not one of the big, tall, lanky body types that you expect to see out on the mound either. So we got one more pitcher that I want to talk about today, and that's a guy that I thought he would be curious to look at because he was another very, very hot commodity in the offseason, and he started extraordinarily slow so far this year. And that is Luis Castillo of the Cincinnati Reds, who have not had a whole lot go right so far early on in the season. And as a matter of fact, as we're going to talk a little bit more Reds even when we get done talking about Luis Castillo. First of all, were you as big on Castillo this year as a lot of other people? And second of all, how do you feel about him? Do you have a raised eyebrow? Or are you concerned about him now, Andrew?
I was completely out on Luis Castillo. Wasn't buying in on the top 100 price in draft season. And a lot of that's just I can't trust 89 innings, especially when like a chunk of those innings come September against, you know, largely call-ups and things like that. So I'm often just going to speculate and stay away from players like this. I mean, he's only got 99, doesn't even have 100 major league innings yet. And I would guess that right now his biggest problem is he's struggling to find the strike zone. Just based on the numbers is that he's only hitting the strike zone 36.1% of the time, which is terrible. Like that's near just above 1 in 3, right? Which is going to probably make you prone to walks. And his 3.6 walk per nine is also reflective of that. So he might be a player right now who a lot of people who were really high on him in the preseason are probably getting a little bit worried, even though it's only 10 days in, because if he can't find the strike zone, he's not going to strike anyone out because no one's going to have a reason to swing. So this is a case of it doesn't matter if he's got a 16.1% swing strike rate, because no one's really got that much of a reason to swing.
Well, and it's important for us to look at both, you know, this is obviously small sample size theater that we're speaking of in general, but also those 89 innings last year, by and large, would not have been in 25 to 35 degree weather would be another right. thing that I would point out. I mean, we would have no evidence or way of knowing if Luis Castillo was a slow starter at the major league level or not when his 90 innings, you know, didn't really start until almost mid-season last year. I would stress that I still think that people should consider him a buy low candidate. But when you're looking to buy low, it's usually when your team needs a potential big boost. And I do think that both when the weather warms up and if he finds himself, he could put this early season small sample size behind him fairly easily. I do forecast things off of team context to some extent, though, and I am pretty concerned about what I see out of the Reds right now. I would be relatively excited, I guess, if I was a Jesse Winker owner, because the other Reds thing I want to speak about affects a couple of players that, and it's the only real non-pitching topic I wanted to touch on briefly. And I'm going to put Andrew under the bus here, and I'm going to start with a different player, and then I'm going to work my way back to the Reds. When it comes to Trey Turner right now, it's a very hot topic amongst all fantasy shows and fantasy outlets that Trey Turner got moved down in the batting lineup to start the season. He's got injury-prone people in front of him, but as I believe he's also got 5 stolen bases already. Now, if the main reason that you drafted Trey Turner was for stolen bases, okay, if at the end of the season he's batted 6th the entire year, but he's got his 50 stolen bases in, then I think it's hard to look back and say, oh, well, Trey Turner killed me because I took him at pick number 4. And getting back to the Reds part of this, if Billy Hamilton, who's now been moved into the 8 hole for a number of different games, if Billy Hamilton doesn't exist, then all of a sudden the number of elite steals guys that there are in the league has shrunk even further. So maybe that overly validates Trey Turner as a early first round pick. So what do you think about that theory?
So I'll put it this way. I think if you drafted Trey Turner at what was the consensus spot for him? 4?
Yep.
And he gets you 50 steals, but doesn't get you 20 home runs, 100 runs, or 80 RBIs, I think you'll still be disappointed because you'll like what you should be left with was, why didn't I just take Starling Marte in the third or fourth round? Because I might end up in the same place or better. I mean, the reason why people were drafting him so high is because of runs, right? Okay, because, you know, he's going to hit in front of Bryce Harper. He's going to give us all of that. So, you know, I'm going to speculate on this, and therefore, you know, it's all going to work out well. And that's why people were paying that price. But at the end of the day, and I mean, Billy Hamilton's hitting eighth because Billy Hamilton is struggling to do anything, I think, right now. Like, he's got one stolen base, largely because he's only been on base three times in a week, or 10 or 11 days, which is putrid, but is also something that Billy Hamilton does. So another reason not to get too excited about it, right? So, I mean, I don't know. Trey Turner's an interesting guy, right? If he hits 300, he gives you 50 stolen bases. I think at the end of the day, it's hard to be too disappointed, but I think there will be some owners who will be, because you probably could have gotten better value out of that draft hole. And that's pretty fair. So I don't know. I think I own one share of Trey Turner. It's in a points league, and it's not necessarily the league I care the most about. From the four hole, I think I drafted once out of, and I took Max Scherzer because I would rather get one of the top four than try to bank on getting a whole bunch of stolen bases at that point.
Well, it's also, I want to clarify the perspective that I come in on Trey Turner. My Trey Turner share, I own him in a keeper league, and I own him for $11. So for $11, it's an absolute no-brainer. If he steals 50 bases as a shortstop, playing in that lineup all year, I can't complain about paying $11 for Trey Turner. That is dramatically different than taking the number four overall pick and using it for Trey Turner. I am just curious because a lot of the guys that we are naturally think of as stolen base guys really don't seem to be panning out right now. I remember the Malik Smith argument that a number of people had, and it doesn't look like Malik Smith is going to be playing all that regularly. Obviously, the Billy Hamilton, the aforementioned Billy Hamilton fiasco that appears to be happening right now. I mean, Starling Marte does have two steals right now, but maybe the value of the stolen base itself is going to be diminished further in the new environment that we know of. You know, Adam Eaton is a guy who's already scuffling a little bit coming back from his ankle injury. So him as a guy who sort of added to this plan of getting your steals from everywhere kind of player. He wasn't someone who was going to carry you. Maybe the average amount of steals will not be what it's been in the past either, which will also add to the value of Trey Turner. You know, and I can see how you would take somebody else who you knew you were going to get 25 or 30 stolen bases out of at a later date. But I still think that Trey Turner, if he gets to 50, I think this value could be elevated higher than you might think. Think of how the player rater has worked in years past with Billy Hamilton. You know, the well-known player rater for ESPN, and that Billy Hamilton turns out to be, when he's had a good season for him, when he's done something with the bat, those steals have thrown him up into the top 15, 20 players. Well, I think that Trey Turner has shown us enough with the bat. He's certainly not a zero with the bat. He's probably playing on the only team in Major League Baseball that would dream of hitting him sixth.
Yeah, I mean, the important thing we have to remember about steals, right, is that there's such a mass scarcity of steals that anyone that steals 50 bases is going to be hugely elevated because they stole 50 bases and league average is below 10. So, like, I mean, and this is something I've talked about before, is that like getting steals guys or home run, like the big home run hitting guys who don't kill you, the Jose Ramirez who's going to give you 20 steals and hit 300 and hit 20 home runs, and you know, Francisco Lindor, and you know, D Gordon especially. I mean, he's a bit more of a zero in the home runs, but he's not going to kill you in your batting average or anywhere else. Those guys become extremely valuable. And I think ultimately, if you get 50 stolen bases from Trey Turner, you essentially end up with D Gordon with a little bit more power, right?
Yeah, that's definitely there. I also think there's something to be said for one more thing about Trey Turner, is that he's shown himself to be an especially streaky player in his you know, short MLB career to this point. Like, he is not really in a great groove right now, and he still has 5 stolen bases. So while we're saying, you know, if he ends up with 50 at the end of the year, so be it, I think it's still quite possible that he ends up with 60. And then all of a sudden you're looking at like 6 major league players worth of stolen bases from one guy. Do you think, I still think he could steal 60 this year. Do you agree?
Yeah, I mean, it looks like Dave Martinez is not against letting guys run. I mean, Michael Taylor's got 4 stolen bases and he's only hitting 167.
Yep. And then on top of it, the other thing that always needs to be pointed out is that look at the relative health that they've had over time of these players, of Anthony Rendon, of Eaton, who's already had a scare with, you know, had a scare with some coming back, maybe playing a little bit too much early in the season, which, why would you not play him when he's hitting, I don't know, 890 or whatever he's hitting? That's absolutely ridiculous. So, I mean, they want to get as much out of Eaton as they can when he's hot as a pistol. I get that. But he also doesn't have a great track record for health. Bryce Harper, I have my fingers crossed that he's going to stay healthy for the entire year and really have one of his best seasons, because I own a lot of shares of Bryce Harper. But health is not what he's known for either. So if at any point, if he was on 50 steal pace and all of a sudden for a month and a half, because one of those players goes down, he ends up hitting first, second, or third and getting some more at bats, that could bump up those runs, could bump up the hopes for some, you know, extra ABs that you didn't have otherwise. And so I think there's still a lot to like about Trey Turner. And I think if you could find the right owner who's really concerned, maybe overly concerned about Trey Turner, and you could buy low on Trey Turner, I would definitely consider doing it now. I am going to stay in the Trey Turner camp here for the entire season, is what my gut tells me. You still overall, I don't think there's any massive reason to have changed how we feel about Trey Turner at this point in the season. Do you?
I don't. I mean, yeah, there's just no reason for it, right? I mean, the reasons why you should be concerned about Trey Turner, the biggest one is health, right? He didn't play 150 games last year, which means he's ultimately never played 150 games in a major league season. So that should be kind of like, if he's healthy, you shouldn't be concerned. I mean, I think everything else, well, at this point in the year, it is way too early to consider, to really think about much of the statistics, right? It's just too early. 10 games isn't enough to make anything of just about anything. I mean, we're not going to proclaim Josh Reddick as an MVP candidate because he's hitting 346 through 8 games, right? Like, he's got 3 home runs, great. I mean, at the same time, you know, I mentioned Michael Taylor's got 4 steals. I mean, no one's jumping out at me like, this is the year Michael Taylor steals 40, right? Because it's, you know, it's just too early for that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's too much speculation, obviously. And I just think that it is a very good sign that Trey Turner is stealing bases at a very good clip, even though he supposedly is in a bad spot in the lineup and he's really not hitting well for him yet at this point. And so I do think there's a good sign that that Trey Turner may still return top four value. It might just not be the to the moon value that people thought if they got 20 home runs, 115 runs scored, and you know, in the 70s in RBIs would have been a pretty great outcome at the beginning of the season. My reaction in this case, and you can almost always push a topic to me on what I'm reacting to because I'm reactionary by nature, is I saw some people on Twitter grouping draft value of Trey Turner with Billy Hamilton, which I see no comparison whatsoever. Like Billy Hamilton hitting eighth and rotating out basically in a four outfielder rotation in Cincinnati versus Trey Turner starting every day and hitting sixth for the Washington Nationals, to me is could not be any further from, you know, from any sort of relevance. Do you agree?
Absolutely. It's not, I mean, you just have to think of this. It is not a bold statement to say that Trey Turner will finish the year at batting at least 40 points higher than Billy Hamilton.
And not only 40 points higher, but, I mean, you think his across-the-board production, it's conceivable that Billy Hamilton is an unusable fantasy option.
Yes, yeah, he has been through 10 days. Just
yeah. I mean, you may have to bench him for a while and hope he gets relatively hot back up to a 290 on base percentage. And that is not Trey Turner. Trey Turner is, in his worst moments, Trey Turner is a far better version of Billy Hamilton. And at his worst moments. And we've seen it. We have enough sample size in Billy Hamilton to think that that's the case. And so that was part of my reaction to what I've been seeing recently around the fantasy industry. And so I just wanted to share that with you guys and give you guys a break from the onslaught of pitching that we use today within the construct of the show. Well, Andrew, thanks too much for your time today. Why don't you go ahead and give people your Twitter handle and tell us what you're working on now that hockey's coming to a close for you?
Sure. Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Andrew K. Dewhurst. Just getting the last of my hockey stuff out. I dropped top 25 players under the age 24, top 25 defensemen, top 25 overall, and top 25 goalies onto Twitter this morning. Need to go back and review and write up how I did on my five bold predictions for the hockey season. Spoiler alert, I think I failed on all of them. And it's time to move into baseball and hopefully get a written article out this week.
Yep, I know the case exactly. I definitely want to get some written work out on the site this week myself. I am Chuck Anderson. I can be reached at Just Chucking It. I think we clearly defined today that swinging strike percentage is a very interesting indicator, and it certainly appears that almost all of the elite pitchers do have very high swinging strike percentages. And I think we pointed out the fact that there's more than one way to skin a cat, which is a very outdated analogy that I'm sure I've offended some listeners by. you know, it still was an analogy that was used for years, and I don't mean it in the harshest form. I mean it as there's a lot of different ways to attack reaching a goal, and that goal is to get major league hitters out. And we pointed to a lot of guys that seem to be on the upswing in swinging strike percentage, and that seems to be helping them push forward. And a number of guys in Quintana and Greinke and Tyone that appear to not necessarily need to use that approach to be highly successful. So keep an eye on swinging strike percentage, and I will keep trying to evolve as well into understanding it more as a concept that that seems to really be surging within the analytics community. Thank you so much for your time today. This was Chuck Anderson and Andrew Dewhurst with a concept podcast for FWFB.